sex when she turned 12. You'll get talked into it, she said, lighting up a cigarette. It'll seem like a good idea at the time. Still smoking, she'd tossed a box of condoms on the coffee table. After that, Mom had let Lauren make her own decisions, as if handing out condoms were a mother's only responsibility. Lauren had been setting her own curfews since childhood. If she didn't come home at all, that was all right, too. Lauren knew that if she told her friends this, they'd ooh and ah and tell her how lucky she was, but she would have traded all that freedom for a single bedtime kiss. He stepped back, smiling, and took hold of her hand. I have a surprise for you. She followed him down the wide hallway. Her heels clicked on the creamy marble tiles. If his parents had been home, she would have tiptoed in silence, with only the two of them here. She could be herself. He turned, walked through the creamy stone archway that separated the hallway from the formal dining room. It looked like a movie set. A long, brilliant wooden table flanked by 16 ornately carved wooden chairs. In the center of the table was a huge arrangement of white roses, white lilies, and greenery. On one end, there were two place settings. Beautiful, translucent bone china, rimmed in gold, sat on ivory silk placemats. Gold flatware glinted in the light of a single candle. She looked up at David, who was smiling so brightly he looked like a kid on the last day of school. It took me forever to find all that shit. My mom has it all buried in all these blue covers. It's beautiful. He led her to her seat, pulled out her chair. When she sat down, he poured sparkling cider into her wine glass. I was gonna raid the old man's wine room, but I knew you'd bitch at me and worry about getting caught. I love you, she said, embarrassed by the tears that stung her eyes. I love you, too. He grinned again. And I'd like to formally ask you to go to the homecoming dance with me. She laughed at that. I'd be honored. They'd gone to every high school dance together. This would be their last homecoming. At the thought, her smile faded. Suddenly she was thinking of next year and the chance that they'd be separated. She looked up at him. She needed to convince him that they needed to be together at school. He believed their love could survive a separation. She wasn't willing to take that chance. He was the only person who'd ever told her, I love you. She didn't want to live without that. Without him. David, I... The doorbell rang. She gasped. Is it your parents? Oh, God! Relax. They called from New York an hour ago. My dad was pissed off because the limo was 5 minutes late. He started for the door. Don't answer it! She didn't want anything to ruin this night for them. What if Jared and the guys had heard about the Haynes' business trip? That was all the seed that was needed. A high school party could blossom in a second. David laughed. Just stay here. She heard him walk down the hallway and open the door. Then she heard voices, a bit of laughter. The door clicked shut. A minute later, David walked into the formal dining room holding a pizza box. Dressed in his low-slung baggy jeans and "Don't be jealous, not everyone can be me" t-shirt, he was so handsome, she had trouble breathing. He came to the table, set the box down. I wanted to cook for you, he said, losing his smile for just a second. I burned the shit out of everything. Lauren stood up slowly, moved in close to him. This is perfect. Really? She heard the neediness in his voice, and it touched her heart in a deep, deep place. She knew how that felt, wanting to please someone. Really, she answered, pressing onto her toes to kiss him. He pulled her into his arms, held her so close she couldn't breathe. By the time they ate the pizza, it was cold. Chapter 6 Livy's new house was a 1970s-style split level on a big corner lot in one of the nicer subdivisions in town. Some of the homes, the really expensive ones, looked out over the ocean. The rest had access to a kidney-shaped swimming pool and a community center that proudly offered kitchen facilities. When Angie had been in school, Havenwood had been the place to live. She remembered sitting around the pool in the summers with her friends, watching the mothers. They were in lounge chairs, most of them, wearing sexy one-piece swimming suits and wide-brimmed hats. Cigarettes and gin and tonics were in every adult hand. She'd thought they were so sophisticated, those white-bred suburban women. Nothing like her spicy Italian mother, who had never spent a day lounging beside a community pool. Her sister must have looked on this place with the same adolescent longing to belong. She parked in Livy's circular driveway, behind the Subaru wagon, and got out of the car. At the front door, she paused. This had to be done carefully. Surgeon doing open heart work carefully. Angie had been awake most of last night thinking about it. Well, about that and other things. It had been another bad night in her lonely bed, and while she'd lain there, remembering what she'd longed to forget and worrying about her future, one thing had come clear. She had to get Livy back to work. Angie had no idea how to run the restaurant by herself, and no desire to do it for long. "I'm sorry, Liv." Those were clearly the opening words. After that, she'd eat a little humble pie and cajole her sister with compliments. Whatever would work, Livy had to return to the restaurant. Angie hadn't wanted to work here for life, after all, just for a month or two until she could sleep alone in her bed again. She knocked on the door and waited. Knocked again. Finally, Livy opened the door. She wore a tight pink velour sweatsuit with J-Lo emblazoned across her chest. "I figured you'd show up. Come on in." She backed up and turned around. There wasn't really room for both of them in the postage stamp-sized entry. Livy went up the carpeted stairs to the formal living room, where a plastic runner lay over the carpet, showing the preferred footpath. Pale blue velvet sofas faced one another, separated by a glossy wood table. The accent chairs were ornately gilt. The fabric was pink and blue flowers. The carpet was a thick, sculpted orange. "We haven't gotten new carpeting yet," Livy said. "The furniture is awesome, though, don't you think?" Angie noticed the taupe-colored naugahyde lazy boy, still in plastic. "Beautiful. Did you decorate yourself?" Livy's plank chest seemed to expand. "I did. I was going to use a decorator, but Sal said I was as good as any of those gals down at Rick's Sofa World." "I'm sure you are. I was thinking maybe I'd even get a job down there. Have a seat." "Coffee?" "Sure." Angie sat down on the sofa. Livy went into the kitchen and came back a few minutes later with two cups of coffee. She handed one to Angie, then sat down across from her. Angie stared into her coffee. There was no point in putting it off. "You know why I'm here." "Of course." "I'm sorry, Livy. I didn't mean to insult you or criticize you or hurt your feelings." "I know that. You've always done it accidentally." "I'm different than you and Mira, as you've pointed out so often. Sometimes I can be too focused."
"Is that what they call it in the big city? Us small-town girls say bitch or obsessive-compulsive."
Livy smiled. "We watch Oprah, too, you know." "Come on, Liv, you're killing me here. Accept my apology and say you'll come back to work. I need your help. I think we can really help Mama out."
Livy took a deep breath. "Here's the thing. I've been helping Mama out. For 5 years I've worked at that damn restaurant and listened to her opinion on everything from my haircut to my shoes. No wonder it took me so long to meet a decent guy."
She leaned forward. "Now I'm a wife. I have a husband who loves me. I don't want to blow it. It's time for me to stop being a Desaria first and everything else second. Sal deserves that."
Angie wanted to be angry at Livy, to bend her sister to her will. Instead, she had a fleeting, painful thought about her own marriage. Maybe at some point she should have made it more important than children. She sighed. It was too late now. "You want a new start," she said quietly, feeling an unexpected connection to her sister. They had this in common.
"Exactly.
You're doing the right thing. I should have..."
"Don't go there, Angie. I know you flip me shit about my three husbands, but I learned something from them. Life keeps going. You think it'll stop, wait for you to be done crying, but it just keeps moving. Don't spend your time looking back. You don't want to miss what's ahead."
Angie looked down at her notes. "I guess this is what's ahead for me right now. Thanks a lot." She tried to smile and looked up. "Could you see your way to helping me, at least? Maybe give me some advice?"
"You're asking me for advice?"
"Just this once, and I probably won't follow it."
Livy laughed. "Read me your list."
"How did you know?"
"You started making lists in third grade. Remember how they used to disappear?"
"Yeah."
"I flushed them down the toilet. They made me crazy. All those things you wanted to accomplish."
She smiled. "I should have made a few lists of my own."
It was as close to a compliment as Angie had ever gotten from her sister. She handed her the notebook.
Livy flipped it open.
Her lips moved as she read. A smile started, slowly at first, then building. By the time she looked up, she was close to laughing. "You want to do all this?"
"What's wrong with it?"
"Have you met our mother? You know, the woman who has put exactly the same ornaments on her Christmas tree for more than 3 decades? Why? Because she likes the tree the way it is."
Angie winced. It was true. Mama was a generous, loving, giving woman, as long as things went exactly the way she wanted them to go. These changes would not be welcomed.
"However," Livy went on, "your ideas could save Desaria's, if that's possible. But I wouldn't want to be in your shoes.
What would you do first?"
Livy looked down at the list. "It's not here."
"What isn't?"
"First, you hire a new waitress. Rosa Canadori has been serving food at Desaria since before you were born. I could learn to play golf in the time it takes her to write down an order. I've been picking up the slack, but..." She shrugged.
"I don't see you waitressing."
Angie couldn't disagree with that.
"Any suggestions?"
Livy grinned. "Make sure she's Italian."
"Very funny."
Angie reached for her pen. "Anything else?"
"You're gonna need more paper. Let's start with the basics."
Angie stood on the sidewalk, looking at the restaurant that had been so much a part of her youth. Mama and Papa had been here every evening. He at the front door, greeting guests, she in the kitchen, cooking for them. Family dinners had taken place at 4:30, before the guests arrived. They'd all sat at a big round table in the kitchen so they wouldn't be seen if customers arrived early. After dinner, Mira and Livy had gone to work waitressing and bussing tables. But not Angie.
"This one is a genius," Papa always said. "She's going to college, so she needs to study."
It had never been questioned. Once Papa spoke, a matter was ended. Angie was going to college. That was that. Night after night, she studied in the kitchen. No wonder she'd gotten a scholarship. Now, here she was, back at the beginning of her life, preparing to save a business she knew nothing about, and tonight, there would be no Livy to help her out. She stared down at her notes. They had filled 4 pages, she and Livy, one idea after another. It was up to Angie to implement the changes. She walked up the steps and went through the front door. The place was already open, of course. Mama had arrived at 3:30, not a minute before, not a minute later, as she'd done every Friday night for 3 decades. Angie heard the clatter and jangle coming from the kitchen. She went in, found her mother cursing.
"Mira is late, and Rosa called in sick tonight. I know she's playing bingo at the Elks." Rosa is sick?
Angie heard the panic in her voice.
She's our only waitress.
Now you are our waitress, Mama said.
It's not that hard, Angela. Just give people what they order.
She went back to making her meatballs. Angie left the kitchen. In the dining rooms, she went from table to table, checking every detail, making sure the salt and pepper shakers were filled, that the place settings were clean and properly placed. 10 minutes later, Mira came rushing through the front door.
I'm sorry I'm late, she called out to Angie on her way to the kitchen. Daniela fell off her bike.
Angie nodded and went back to the menu, studying it as if it were a Cliff Notes guide and she were cramming for a test. At 5:45, the first customers arrived, Dr. and Mrs. Feinstein, who ran the clinic in town. 20 minutes later, the Giuliani family arrived. Angie greeted them all as her father would have, then showed them to their tables. For the first few minutes, she actually felt good, as if she were part of her heritage at last. Her mother beamed at her, nodded encouragingly. By 6:15, she was in trouble. How could 7 people generate so much work?
More water, please. I asked for Parmesan. Where's our bread and the oil?
You might be a great copywriter, Angela, Mama said to her at one point, but I would not tip you well. Too slow.
Angie couldn't disagree. She headed for the Feinstein's table and set down the plate of cannelloni.
I'll be right back with your scampi, Mrs. Feinstein, she said, then ran for the kitchen.
I hope Dr. Feinstein isn't finished by the time his wife is served, Mama said, clucking in disapproval. Mira, make those meatballs bigger.
Angie backed out of the kitchen and hurried back to the Feinstein's table. As she was serving the scampi, she heard the front door open. A bell tinkled. More customers. Oh, no, she thought. She turned slowly and saw Livy. Her sister took one look at her and burst out laughing. Angie straightened.
You're here to laugh at me?
The princess working at DeSaria's?
Of course I'm here to laugh at you.
Livy touched her shoulder. And to help you out. By the end of the evening, Angie had a pounding headache.
Okay, it's official. I'm the worst waitress in history.
She looked down at her clothes. She'd spilled red wine down her apron and dragged her sleeve in the creme anglaise. A discoloration on her pants was almost certainly from the lasagna. She sat down at a table in the back corner beside her sister.
I can't believe I wore cashmere and high heels. No wonder Livy laughs every time she looks at me.
You'll get better, Mira promised. Here, fold napkins.
Well, I damn sure can't get worse.
Angie couldn't help laughing, though it wasn't funny. In truth, she hadn't expected it to be so hard. All her life, things had come easily to her. She'd simply been good at whatever she tried. Not exceptional, perhaps, but better than average. She'd graduated from UCLA in 4 years, thank you, with a very respectable grade point, and she'd immediately been hired by the best ad agency in Seattle. Frankly, this whole table-waiting handicap came as a shock.
It's humiliating.
Mira looked up from the napkins.
Don't worry. Rosa hardly ever calls in sick. Usually she can handle the so-called crowd.
Angie sat down across from her sister. I had a meeting with Livy today. We came up with some ideas for improving business.
That's great.
I know, but... Angie looked down at her hands. 2 bright pink burn spots marred her skin. Fortunately, she'd spilled the hot sauce on herself and not on Mrs. Giuliani.
I don't know if I can do this.
Mira folded the thick white napkin into a swan and pushed it across the table. Angie was reminded of the night Papa had taught her how to turn a plain square of fabric into this bird. When she looked up and saw her sister's smile, she knew the reminder had been intentional.
It took Livy and me weeks to learn how to do that. We sat on the floor by Papa, trying to copy his every move so he would smile at us and say, "Good job, my princesses!" We thought we were doing so well.
Then you joined us and learned how to fold it in 3 tries.
This one, Papa said, kissing your cheek, can do anything.
The memory should have made her smile, but this time she saw more. That must have been tough on you and Livy.
Mira waved off the concern.
That wasn't my point. This place, Desaria's, is in your blood just as it's in ours. Not being a part of it for all those years doesn't change who you are. You're one of us, and you can do whatever needs to be done. Papa believed in you, and so do I.
I'm afraid. Mira smiled gently. That's not you.
Angie turned her head and stared through the window at the empty street. Leaves fell to the ground, skittered across the rough cement sidewalk.
It's who I've become.
She hated to admit it.
Mira leaned forward.
Can I be honest?
Absolutely not.
Angie tried to laugh, but when she looked at her sister's earnest face, she couldn't do it.
You've gotten self-centered in the last few years. I don't mean selfish. Wanting a baby and then losing Sophie, it made you quiet. Alone, somehow.
Alone, somehow, Angie thought. It was true.
I felt as if I were hanging on by a thread, and there was a huge hole beneath me.
Then you fell anyway. She thought about that. She'd lost her daughter, her father, and her husband in the same year. That was certainly the fall she'd been afraid of.
Sometimes I think I'm still falling. At night, it's especially bad.
Maybe it's time to look outward.
I have the restaurant. I'm trying.
What about all the hours when we're closed?
Angie swallowed.
It's hard, she admitted. I try to study and make notes. A job can't be enough.
Angie wished she could argue with the veracity of the statement, but she'd learned the truth of it long ago when she'd loved her job and longed for a baby.
No.
Maybe it's time to reach out to someone else in need.
Angie thought about that. The first image that popped into her mind was the teenager she'd seen in the Safeway parking lot. Angie had been helped by helping the girl. That night she'd slept through until morning.
Maybe that was the answer. Helping someone else.
She felt herself start to smile.
My Mondays are free.
Mira smiled back.
And most of your mornings.
For the first time ever, Lauren woke up feeling completely safe. David's arms were around her, holding her close, even in sleep. She reveled in the feel of it, smiling, imagining a married life that would always be this way. She laid there a long time, tucked up against him, watching him sleep. Finally, she eased away from him and rolled out of bed. She'd make him breakfast and serve it to him in bed. At his chest of drawers, she paused and opened the top drawer. Finding a long T-shirt, she put it on and went downstairs. The kitchen was amazing. All granite and stainless steel and mirrored surfaces. The pots and pans shone silver in the light. She scouted through the cupboards and the refrigerator, finding everything she needed to make scrambled eggs, bacon, and pancakes. When breakfast was ready, she put everything on a beautiful wooden tray and carried it upstairs. She found David sitting up in bed, yawning.
"There you are," he said, grinning at her entrance. "I was worried like I'd ever leave you."
She crawled up into bed beside him and settled the tray between them.
"This looks great," he said, kissing her cheek.
As they ate breakfast, they talked about ordinary things. The upcoming SAT test, football, school gossip. David talked about the Porsche that he and his father were restoring. It was the only thing he and his dad did together, and so David obsessed about the car. He loved the hours they spent in the garage. In truth, he talked about it so often she hardly listened anymore. He launched into something about gear ratios and speed off the line, and she found her interest waning. She glanced out the window. Sunlight flooded the glass,
And suddenly she was thinking about California and their future. She'd lost track of how often she'd organized her college brochures based on scholarship feasibility. By her calculations, her best shot at a full ride was at private colleges. Of these, her favorite was the University of Southern California. It combined world-class athletics with top-drawer academics. Unfortunately, it was almost an 8 hours drive from Stanford. Somehow she had to convince David to consider USC. The second alternative was for her to choose Santa Clara. But truthfully, she'd had enough of Catholic school.
Totally tight. Perfect leather.
Lauren, are you listening? She turned to him. Of course. You were talking about the gear ratio.
He laughed. Yeah, about an hour ago. I knew you weren't listening.
She felt her cheeks heat up. I'm sorry. I was thinking about college. He picked up the tray and put it on the oversized nightstand to his left.
You're always worrying about the future.
And you never do.
It won't help, he shrugged.
Before she could answer, he leaned over and kissed her. All thoughts of college and their uncertain future disappeared. She lost herself in his kiss, in his arms. Hours later, when they finally pushed the blankets back and got out of bed, she'd almost forgotten her worries.
Let's go ice skating over in Longview, he said, burrowing through his drawers for the shirt he wanted to wear.
Ordinarily, she loved it when they went ice skating. She glanced down at her pile of clothes. Her coat's raggedness made her wince, and she knew there were holes in her socks.
I can't go today. I need to find a job.
On Sunday? She looked up at him. Just then, it felt as if so much more than a few feet of floor separated them. The want ads come in today's paper. I can be the first application on Monday. David moved toward her.
How much?
How much what?
Your rent. How behind is she?
Lauren felt her cheeks flush. I never said, you never do. I'm not stupid, Lo.
How much do you owe?
She wished the ground would open up and swallow her. 200. But Monday is the first.
200. That's what I paid for my steering wheel and shift knob.
She didn't know what to say to that. For him, that amount of money was pocket change. She broke eye contact and bent down for her clothes.
Let me know,
she said, not daring to look at him. Tears burned her eyes. Her shame was almost overwhelming. It shouldn't be, she knew. He loved her. He told her that all the time, but still, why not? She slowly straightened, finally looked at him.
All my life, she said, I've watched my mom take money from men. It starts out as nothing, beer or cigarette money. Then $50 for a new dress or $100 to pay the electric bill. It changes things, that money.
I'm not like those guys, and you know it. We're different.
Yes, I need us to be different. Don't you see?
He touched her face so gently she wanted to cry. I see that you won't let me help you.
How could she explain it to him, that helping her would be a river that would suck them under?
Just love me, she whispered, putting her arms around him and holding on tightly. He pulled her off her feet, kissed her until she was dizzy and smiling again.
We're going skating, and that's it.
She wanted to lose herself in the coldness, going around and around with nothing to keep her grounded except David's warm hand.
I don't have warm enough clothes. I'd have to stop at home.
She couldn't help smiling. It felt good to give in, to take the day off from her troubles. He took her hand and led her out of his bedroom and down the hallway toward his parents' bedroom.
David, what are you doing?
She followed him, frowning. He opened the door and went to the closet, opening that door as well. A light automatically came on. The closet was bigger than Lauren's living room.
Her coats are back there. Pick one.
Lauren moved woodenly forward until she was standing in front of Mrs. Haynes's coats. There were at least a dozen of them. Leather, cashmere, wool, suede. Not one showed the slightest sign of wear. Why did God give so much to some families and so little to others? Pick one and let's go! Lauren couldn't seem to move. Her heart was beating too quickly. It made her slightly breathless. She felt vulnerable suddenly, laid bare by her neediness. She backed away, turned to David. If he noticed how bright her eyes were or how brittle her smile, he gave no indication.
I just remembered. I did bring my coat. I'll be fine.
You sure?
Of course. I'll just borrow one of your sweaters. Now, let's go.
Chapter 7 Angie followed the coast road to the edge of town. On her left, the Pacific Ocean seemed to be gearing up for an autumn storm. White surf battered the cement-gray sand, sent trees sprawling onto land. The sky was an ominous gunmetal gray, and wind whistled through the branches along the shore and clattered against her windshield. The rain was so heavy she had her wipers set on high, and still they couldn't keep up. At Azalea Lane, she turned left and found herself on a small, narrow street that once had been paved. Now the potholes seemed to come more often than the asphalt. Her car wobbled down the uneven road like a drunkard. Help Your Neighbor House was at the very end of this dilapidated street, in a pale blue Victorian house that stood in sharp contrast to the faded mobile homes that made up the rest of the neighborhood. While most of the other fences had "Beware of Dog" signs out front, here it said simply, "Welcome." She pulled into the gravel parking lot, surprised to find a crowd of cars and trucks already there. It was not yet 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, yet the place was busy. She parked next to a battered red pickup with blue doors and a gun rack in the window. Collecting her donation, canned goods, some toiletries, and several turkey gift certificates from the local grocery store, she followed the gravel path up to the brightly painted front door. A ceramic gnome grinned up at her from the corner of the porch. Smiling, she opened the door and stepped into pandemonium. The entire downstairs of the house was full of people talking and moving around. Several children were clustered together by the window, playing with Legos. Women with tired faces and ragged smiles circled them, filling out forms on clipboards. In a far corner, a pair of men were unloading canned goods from boxes on the floor.
"May I help you?"
It took Angie a moment to realize that she was being addressed. When it sank in, she smiled at the woman who'd spoken. "I'm sorry, it's so busy in here."
"A circus! It'll be like this through the holidays. We hope, anyway."
She frowned at Angie, tapping a pen against her chin.
"You look familiar."
"Hometown girls usually do." She stepped around the toys on the floor and took a seat opposite the woman's desk. "I'm Angie Malone. Used to be Desaria." The woman thumped her hand on the desk, rattling the fishbowl.
"Of course! I graduated with Mira! Dana Herder!"
She offered her hand. Angie shook it.
"What can we do for you?"
"I'm home for a while." Dana's ruddy face creased into Sharpay-like folds.
"We heard about your divorce."
Angie struggled to keep smiling.
"Of course you did. Small town."
"Very. Anyway, I'm working at the restaurant for a while, and I thought..." She shrugged. "As long as I'm here, maybe it would be good to do some volunteer work." Dana nodded.
"I started here when Doug left me. Doug Reimer, remember him? JV wrestling captain? He's living with Kelly Santos now. Bitch."
She smiled, but it was shaky and didn't light her eyes.
"This place has helped me."
Angie sat back in the chair, feeling strangely boneless. "I'm one of that group," she thought. "The unmarrieds. People would assume things about her because she'd failed at marriage.
How had she not realized this?
What can I do to help?
Lots of things. Here.
Dana reached into the drawer of her desk and pulled out a two-color brochure.
This outlines our services. Read it. See what appeals to you.
Angie took the brochure and flipped it open. She had just started to read when Dana said,
Could you go give your donations to Ted, over there? He'll be leaving in a few minutes.
Oh, sure.
Angie carried her box of donations over to the two men, who took them with a smile and went back to work. She headed back to the lobby area and sat down on one of the molded plastic seats that formed a makeshift waiting area. She flipped through the brochure, reading about the services offered. Family counseling, parent and child center, domestic violence treatment program, food bank. There was a list of fundraising events, golf tournaments, silent auctions, bicycle races, dance marathons. Every day, the generous citizens of our community stop by with donations of food, money, clothing, or time. In this way, we help ourselves and each other.
Angie felt a shiver of something move through her just then. When she realized that it was Hope, she looked up, smiling, wishing there was someone she could tell. Her next thought was, Conlon. And her smile faded. It struck her that there would be lots of moments like this in the coming months. Times when, for a split second, just long enough to hurt, she'd forget that she was alone now. She forced herself to smile again, though it felt stretched. Unnatural. That was when she saw the girl. She walked through the front door, looking like a drowned puppy, dripping water from her nose, her hair, her hemline. Her long, soaking wet hair was red, although the exact hue was impossible to tell. Her skin was Kidman pale, and her eyes were a deep and impenetrable brown. Too big for her face, they made her look impossibly young. Freckles dotted her cheeks and the bridge of her nose. It was the girl from the parking lot, the one who'd been posting "Will Work" flyers on windshields. The girl paused at the door. She tightened her coat around her, but the thing was so ragged it was a useless gesture. The coat was too small and frayed at the sleeves. She went to the reception desk. Dana looked up, smiled, said something. Angie couldn't help herself. She eased to her feet and moved within earshot.
I read about the coat drive, the girl said, crossing her arms and shivering just a little.
We started collecting just last week. You'll need to give us your name and number. We'll call you when your size comes in.
It's for my mother, the girl said. She's a size small.
Dana tapped the pen against her chin and studied the girl.
What about a coat for you? That one seems...
The girl laughed. It sounded sharp, nervous.
I'm fine.
She bent forward and wrote something on a piece of paper, then shoved it across the desk.
I'm Lauren Ribido. There's my number. Just call me when one comes in. Thanks.
She made a beeline for the door. Angie stood there, unmoving, staring at the closed door. Her heart was beating too quickly. She felt exposed somehow. Vulnerable, although she couldn't imagine why. Go after her. The idea came to her full-blown, startling her with its intensity.
It was a crazy idea. Why?
She didn't know, had no answer. All she knew was that she felt connected to that poor teenage girl who was in need of a coat and yet requested one for her mother. She got up, took a step forward, then another. Before she knew it, she was outside. Rain hammered the grass into submission, collected in brown puddles at the slightest indentation in the ground. The fire-red hedge that outlined the lot glistened with moisture and shook with wind. Down at the end of the road, the girl was running. Angie got into her car, turned on the lights and wipers, and backed out of the parking lot. As she drove down the bumpy street, her headlights illuminating the girl's figure. She wondered what the hell she was doing.
Stalking, her practical self said.
Helping, the dreamer responded. She came to the corner and slowed.
stopped. She was just about to roll down the window and offer the girl a ride. No smart girl would say yes to that. When a number 7 bus pulled up and parked. Its brakes wheezed, the doors clattered open. The girl bounded up the stairs and disappeared. The bus drove off. Angie followed it all the way to town. At the corner of Driftwood Way and the highway, she had a choice: turn for home or follow the bus. For no reason that she could articulate, she followed the bus. Finally, deep in the darklands of West End, the girl exited the bus. She walked through a neighborhood that would have scared most people and went into the remarkably misnamed luxury apartments. A few moments later, a light came on in a window on the 4th floor. Angie parked at the curb and stared up at the building. It reminded her of something out of a Roald Dahl novel, all decaying wood and blank, black spaces. No wonder the girl had been putting "Will Work" flyers on windshields. "You can't save them all," Conlon used to say to her when she'd cry at the unfairness of the world. "I can't save any of them," had always been her answer. Then she'd had him to hold her when she felt like this. Now, it was up to her. She couldn't save that girl, certainly. It wasn't her place to do so. But she could help her, couldn't she? It all came down to fate. That was what Angie thought as she stood on the street in front of the clothesline's display window. There it was, right in front of her. A dark green, knee-length winter coat with faux fur around the collar, down the front, and encircling the cuffs. It was exactly what the girls were wearing this year. In fact, Angie had had a coat very much like this one in 9th grade. It would look beautiful on a pale-skinned, red-haired girl with sad brown eyes. She spent a nanosecond or two trying to talk herself out of it. After all, she didn't know the girl, and this was none of Angie's business. The arguments were weak and didn't change her mind. Sometimes a thing just felt right, and truthfully, she was glad to have someone to think about besides herself. She pushed open the door and went into the small store. A bell tinkled overhead at her entrance. The sound took her back in time until, for a moment, she was a pencil-thin cheerleader with Brillo pad black hair following her sisters into the only clothing store in town. Now, of course, there were several stores, even a JCPenney's department store out on the highway. But back then, the clothesline had been the place for Jordache jeans and leg warmers. That cannot be Angie DeSaria. The familiar voice pulled Angie out of her reverie. She heard a flurry of footsteps, rubber-soled shoes on linoleum, and started smiling. Mrs. Costanza made her way through the rounders of clothing, bobbing and weaving with a finesse that Holyfield would envy. At first, all of her that was visible was a teased pile of dyed black hair, then thin, drawn-on black eyebrows, and finally her cherry red smile. "Hey, Miss Costanza," Angie said, smiling at the woman who'd fitted her for her first bra and sold her every pair of shoes for 17 years. "I cannot believe it's you." She clapped her hands together, palm to palm, to protect her long, heart-spangled fingernails. "I heard you were in town, of course, but I figured you would buy your clothes in the big city. Let me look at you." She latched on to Angie's shoulder and spun her around. "Jeans by Roberto Cavalli, a good Italian boy. This is good, but your shoes aren't sensible for walking in town. You'll need new ones. And I hear you're working at the restaurant. You'll need shoes for that." Angie couldn't contain her smile. "You're right, as always." Mrs. Costanza touched her cheek. "Your mama is so happy to have you home." "It has been a bad year." Angie's smile faltered. "For all of us. He was a good man. The best." For a moment, they fell silent, staring at each other, each thinking about her father. Finally, Angie said, "Before you sell me a pair of comfortable shoes,
I'm interested in the coat in the window, and I need another one in a size 4.
That coat is awfully young for you, Angela.
I know, in the city, it's not for me, it's for a friend.
Ah, she nodded. It is what all the girls want this year. Come.
An hour later, Angie left the clothesline with 2 winter coats, 2 pairs of Angora gloves, a pair of non-name brand tennis shoes, and a pair of black flats for work. Her first stop was the packaging store in town, where she boxed up the coats. She intended to drop them off at Help Your Neighbor. She really did. But somehow she found herself parked on the girl's street, staring up at the dilapidated apartment building. She gathered up the box and headed for the front door. Her heels caught in cracks in the paved walkway threw her off balance. She imagined that she looked like Quasimodo, lurching forward, if anyone were watching, which, frankly, the blank, dark windows denied. The main door was unlocked. Indeed, it hung off one hinge. She opened it, stepped into a gloomy darkness. There was a bank of mailboxes to her left with numbers on them. The only name listed was that of the manager's, Dolores Mock, 1A. Angie was across the hall from 1A. Hefting the box under her arm, she went to the door and knocked. When no one answered, she tried again.
"I'm coming," someone said.
The door opened. A middle-aged woman with a hard face and soft eyes stood there. She wore a floral house dress and Converse high-top tennis shoes. A red kerchief covered most of her hair.
"Are you Ms. Mock?" Angie asked, feeling suddenly conspicuous.
She felt the woman's wariness.
"I am. What do you want?"
"This package. It's for Lauren Ribido."
"Lauren," the woman said, her mouth softening into a smile. "She's a good girl."
Then she frowned again.
"You don't look like a delivery person."
Mrs. Mock's gaze slid pointedly down to Angie's shoes, then back up. "It's a winter coat," she said. In the silence that followed, Angie felt compelled to explain.
"I was at Help Your Neighbor when she, Lauren, came in, asking for a coat for her mother. I thought, why not get 2? So here I am. I could leave the box with you. Would that be okay?"
"You'd best. They aren't home now."
Angie handed her the box. She had just started to turn away when the woman asked her name.
"Angela DeSaria."
"From the restaurant?"
Angie smiled. "That's me."
"My daughter used to love that place."
"Used to. That was the problem with the restaurant. People had forgotten about it."
"Bring her by again. I'll make sure she gets the royal treatment."
Angie knew instantly that she'd said something wrong.
"Thanks," Mrs. Mock said in a husky voice.
"I'll do that."
And the door shut. Angie stood there, wondering what she'd done wrong. Finally, with a sigh, she turned and headed for the door. Once in her car, she sat there, staring through the windshield at the rundown neighborhood. A bright yellow school bus pulled up to the corner and stopped. Several children spilled down the steps and jumped down onto the street. They were young, probably first or second graders. No moms waited for them on the corner, talking to one another, sipping expensive lattes and Starbucks cups. She felt that old wrenching in her chest, the blossoming of her familiar ache. She swallowed hard, watching them move together in a pack, kicking a can down the sidewalk and laughing. It wasn't until they were almost out of eyeshot that she realized what was missing. Coats. Not one of those kids was wearing a winter coat, even though it was cold outside and by next month it would be colder still. The idea came to her right then, full-blown. A coat drive at DeSaria's. For every coat donated, they'd offer a free dinner. It was perfect. She jammed her key in the ignition and started the car. She couldn't wait to tell Mira.
Lauren hurried across campus. Cold air smacked her in the face. Her breath released in white plumes that faded fast as she walked. David stood at the flagpole waiting for her. At her appearance, he smiled brightly. She could tell he'd been waiting a while. His cheeks were ruddy pink. "Damn, it's cold out here," he said, pulling her close for a long, lingering French kiss. They walked across the commons, waving and smiling at friends, talking quietly to each other. Outside her classroom, they stopped. David gave her another kiss, then headed down to his own class. He hadn't gone more than a few feet when he stopped, turned around. "Hey, I forgot to ask. What color tux should I get for homecoming?" She felt the blood drain from her face. Homecoming. The dance was 10 days away. Jeez, she'd organized all of the decorations and set up the DJ and the lights. How could she have forgotten the most important thing? A dress. "Lauren?" Black, she answered, trying to smile. "Black is always safe." "You got it," he said with an easy smile. Things were always easy for David. He didn't have to wonder how to finance a new dress. Forget about shoes and a wrap. All through her trigonometry class, she was distracted. As soon as class was over, she bolted to a quiet corner in the library and burrowed through her wallet and backpack looking for money. $6.12. That was all she had to her name right now. A frown settled into place on her forehead and stayed there for the rest of the day. After school, she skipped her decorating meeting and raced home. The bus let her off at the corner of Apple Way and Cascade Street. It was raining hard. No longer a silvery mist, this was an onslaught that turned the world cold and gray. Raindrops hit the pavement in such rapid succession it looked as if the streets were boiling. Her canvas hood was ineffective at best. Water dripped down the sides of her face and burrowed cold and sticky against her collar. Her backpack, stuffed full of books and notebooks and handouts, seemed to weigh a ton. On top of all that, her vinyl shoes had broken a heel 3 blocks ago, so now she was limping down the hill toward home. At the corner, she waved at Bubba, who waved back, then returned to his tattooing. The neon sign flickered tiredly above his head. The smaller sign, posted in the window, "I tattooed your parents," was streaked with rain. She limped forward, past the now-closed Hair Apparent, where her mother allegedly worked, past the mini-mart run by the Chu family, and the teriyaki takeout that the Ramirez family owned and operated. Outside of her apartment building, she stopped, loath, suddenly, to go inside. She closed her eyes and imagined the home she would someday have. Buttery yellow walls, down-filled furniture, huge picture windows, a wraparound porch overgrown with flowers. She tried to latch on to the familiar dream, but it floated past her, insubstantial as smoke. She forcibly changed her mindset. Wishing and hoping had never put food on the table or brought Mama home 1 minute early. It certainly didn't get a girl a homecoming gown. She walked down the cracked concrete path, past the box of garden tools that Mrs. Mock had set outside last week in a feeble attempt to encourage tenant pride. Soon, they would begin to rust. Those tools would be ruined long before someone bothered to cut back the leggy roses and runaway blackberry bushes that covered the back half of the lot. The dark hallway greeted her. She went upstairs and found the door to their apartment standing open. "Mom!" she called out, pushing through the unlatched door. There was a cigarette burning in an ashtray on the coffee table. The mound of used butts was huge. Here and there, smoked-down cigarettes lay littered across the formica table. The apartment was empty. Mom had probably come home from work about 5, if she'd even made it to work in the first place, then changed her clothes from white trash beautician to biker slut and run off to her favorite bar stool. Lauren hurried down the hallway and into her bedroom, praying all the way there. Please, please, please! It was empty beneath her pillow. Mom had found the money. Chapter 8. Lauren meant to move. She meant to get up, put on fresh makeup, and borrow Susie Mock's suit again. But somehow she sat there, on the floor, staring at the stack of cigarette butts in the ashtray on the coffee table. How much of her $25 had literally gone up in smoke? She wished she could cry the way she once would have. The tears, she now knew, meant hope. When your eyes dried up, there was none. The door swung open, cracked against the wall. The whole apartment shuddered at the force of it. A beer bottle rolled off the sofa cushion and thumped to the shag carpet. Her mother stood in the doorway, wearing a pleated black miniskirt with black boots and a tight blue T-shirt. The top, which Lauren thought looked suspiciously new, made her look much too thin. The once beautiful bone structure in her face was now a collection of sharp edges and dark hollows. Booze and cigarettes and too many bad years had sanded her beauty down, leaving only the stunning green of her eyes. Against the harsh pallor of her face, Mom's eyes were still arresting. Once Lauren had thought her mother was the most lovely woman in the world. Lots of people had back then. For years, Mom had gotten by on her looks. As her beauty had faded, so had her ability to cope. Mom brought a cigarette to her lips and took a long drag, exhaling sharply. "You're staring at me." Lauren sighed. So it was going to be one of those nights. The kind where Mom came home more sober than drunk and pissed off about it. Lauren got slowly to her feet, started picking up the mess in the living room. "I'm not staring." "You should be at work," Mom said, kicking the door shut behind her. "So should you." Mom laughed at that and flopped down on the sofa, putting her feet up on the coffee table. "I was headed that way. You know how it is." "Yeah, I know. You have to walk past the tides." She heard the bitterness in her voice and wished it weren't there. "Don't start with me." Lauren went to the sofa and sat down on the arm. "You took the $20 from under my pillow. That was my money, Mom." Mom put out one cigarette and lit up another. "The homecoming dance is less than 2 weeks away. She paused, hating to admit her need, but what choice did she have? "I need a dress." Mom looked up at her. Smoke swirled in the air, seeming to exaggerate the distance between them. "I got knocked up at a school dance," Mom finally said. Lauren fought the urge to roll her eyes. "I know." "You want my help? I'll give you some advice." "No, that's fuck the dance." Lauren couldn't believe it still hurt after all these years. When would she stop believing that her mother might change? "Thanks, Mom. As usual, you're a big help." "You'll see. When you're older." Mom leaned back, exhaling smoke. Her mouth trembled, and for the merest of moments, she looked sad. "None of it matters. What you want, what you dream of. You live with what's left." If Lauren believed that, she'd never be able to get out of bed or off a bar stool. She reached down, brushed the blonde hair out of her mother's eyes. "It's going to be different for me, Mom." Her mother almost smiled. "I hope so," she murmured so softly Lauren had to lean forward to hear it. "I'll find a way to pay the rent and buy a dress," she said, finding her courage again. It had left her for a few moments there, and without its heat she had gone cold and numb, but now it was back. She slid off the arm of the sofa and went back to her mother's bedroom. In the overstuffed closet, she looked for something she could redo into a dress for the dance. She was holding up a black satin nightgown when the doorbell rang.
She didn't answer it, but her mother yelled out to her,
"Ms. Mock's here!"
Lauren swore under her breath. If only Mom hadn't opened the door. Forcing a smile, she tossed the tiny negligee on the bed and went back into the living room. Mrs. Mock was there, smiling. A big cardboard box was on the floor at her feet. Beside her, Mom was buttoning up a beautiful black pants coat made of the softest wool. It had a tapered waist and a shawl collar. Lauren frowned.
"It's an old lady's coat," Mom muttered, walking down the hallway toward the bathroom.
"Mrs. Mock?" Lauren said.
"There's one for you, too."
She bent down and pulled a green coat with faux fur trim from the box. Lauren gasped.
"For me?"
It was almost exactly the coat Melissa Stonebridge wore, the richest, most popular girl at Fircrest. Lauren couldn't help reaching for it, touching the soft fur.
"You shouldn't have. I mean, I can't..."
She drew her hand back. "Mrs. Mock couldn't afford this."
"It's not for me,"
Mrs. Mock said, her mouth forming into a sad and knowing smile.
"A woman from Help Your Neighbor brought it by. Her name was Angela. She's one of the Desarias, you know, from that restaurant on Driftwood. I'd say she could afford it."
Charity. The woman somehow had seen Lauren and pitied her.
"This coat is too old for me," Mom said from the other room. "What does yours look like, Lauren?"
"Take it,"
Mrs. Mock said, pushing the coat toward Lauren. She couldn't help herself. She took it, slipped it on, and suddenly she was warm. She hadn't realized until just then how long she'd been cold.
"How do you say thank you for something like this?" she whispered.
Mrs. Mock's eyes filled with understanding.
"It's hard," she said quietly, "being the one who needs help."
"Yeah."
They stared at each other a moment longer. Finally, Lauren tried to smile.
"I guess I'll go to the restaurant and see if I can find her. Say thank you."
"That's a good idea."
Lauren glanced down the hallway.
"I'll be back in a while, Mom."
"Bring me a better coat,"
Mom yelled back. Lauren didn't dare look at Mrs. Mock. They walked out of the apartment and down the stairs together, neither one speaking. Outside, Lauren waved goodbye to Mrs. Mock, who, although hidden, was always at her curtains, watching what happened on her street. In less than 30 minutes, Lauren was at Desaria's restaurant, opening the door. The first thing she noticed was the aroma. The place smelled heavenly. She realized how hungry she was.
"I guess you found me."
Lauren hadn't even noticed the woman's arrival, and yet they were standing almost face to face. The woman was only an inch or so taller than Lauren, but she was a commanding presence somehow. First of all, she was beautiful, movie star beautiful, with her black hair and dark eyes and big smile, and her clothes looked like something out of an expensive catalog. Black pants with flared legs, high-heeled black boots, and a pale yellow scoop-neck sweater. There was something familiar about her.
"Are you Angela Desaria?"
"I am. Angie, please." She looked at Lauren, and there was an almost liquid softness in her brown eyes. "And you're Lauren Ribido."
"Thank you for the coat."
Her voice snagged on the sentiment, sounded thick. She realized suddenly where she'd seen this woman before.
"You're the woman who gave me money."
Angie smiled, but it seemed off somehow, not quite real. "You probably think I'm stalking you. I'm not. It's just..." Lauren thought weirdly that she would say it was fate. "I'm new in town and kind of at loose ends. I saw you and wanted to help."
"You did."
Lauren felt it again, the emotion thickening her voice. "I'm glad to hear that." They stood there, staring at each other. Finally, Lauren couldn't stand it. She forced a little laugh and said, If you really want to help, I could use a job. Angie seemed surprised by that. She took a step back and studied Lauren. Have you ever waitressed before?